Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Forgecast. My name's Sam Towns.
I'm Alex Norton.
And I'm Jordan Lamote.
That's right. We've got an awesome guest for you today. But before we get into the interview, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor.
This week's Forgecast is moistening your ear sponges thanks to the good-looking fellows at Nordic Edge, suppliers of all things knife-making. All the goodies you'll need on your knife-making adventures can be found at their easy-to-use website, nordicedge.com.au, so give them a visit to stock up today. You'll notice that our sponsor is no longer Weber Abrasives. We just wanted to thank Rob Weber for all of the years of support of the podcast. He has unfortunately, due to personal circumstances, had to sell his business. So huge thank you to Rob for all the years of helping us out, and we wish you all the best moving forward, mate, if you're listening.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Jordan.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate being here.
Yeah, no, thank you for joining us, Jordan. It's been really awesome to finally meet you, and hopefully you enjoy your time on the show. But before we get to you, let's take a moment to run over to Alex. What have you been doing this week?
Swimming. Tasmania's been hit with some really bad weather events, and everywhere around me is flooding.
I saw the drone photos. It's nuts.
Yeah, my mate Adam has a drone, and he sent it up, and it was only then that we really got a full picture of how bad it is. And then like there were little hints, like I'd try and get some groceries ordered to be delivered, and they're like, "No, we're not going to deliver it to you at the moment." And it's like, "Oh, okay." And then I found out that there's three main bridges that lead, like, that I can get out of where I am, and two of them are destroyed now; they're gone. There's one left, and I just found out that there's going to be another equal-sized weather event start tomorrow. Yeah, fun times. I luckily didn't lose any tools, but a lot of water got in places that I really didn't want it to be.
Yeah, I had a lot of people messaging me when you went quiet for like that period there, and then the first video coming back is you like hot air gun drying your lathe.
Yeah, with all the electronics out. Yeah. It's not a good situation because I work out of a 150-year-old shed that is more holes than shed currently. So it's, yeah, one of those things. But, you know, nature always wins in the end. You can only just do what you can do. But luckily where my house is about 35 meters above the normal water level of the nearby river. So if it floods by 35 meters, I think Tasmania has bigger problems.
Yeah, you need to build an ark.
Pretty sure that most of Tasmania would be underwater at that point.
Yeah, I reckon so. I personally will be all right. Hopefully the tools and workshop and everything stay all right. But we'll find out. Currently it's beautiful blue skies, but weirdly and unseasonably hot today, which usually means that we're about to get dumped on. So, yeah, we'll see. Yep. Hopefully you still have a co-host next week.
I'll be optimistic.
I'll be out nude in the backyard doing a rain dance. Like the opposite rain dance. Send it back. If that doesn't scare it off, I don't know what will. Other than that, in happier news, the current project that I'm working on has been so intricately detailed, more so than anything else that I've ever done. So I built myself a little ad hoc jeweler's station with the hanging skin to catch the small pieces that inevitably fall, and jeweler's fork and all that sort of thing. And it's one of those things that I finally got around to doing after wanting to for 2 years. And now that I have it, I can't imagine not having it. Because I've been working on the clockwork knife. It's a steampunk liner lock folder that is made of old watch parts. And I've basically been living in an optimizer at this jeweler's station under harsh lights for a couple of weeks now. And I've got another couple of weeks work to go on this thing. But it's looking absolutely stellar. I'm really happy with how it's coming out.
I've been seeing some photos on Instagram. It's looking good.
It's a wild project. But I spent yesterday, all of yesterday, it was about 7 hours straight just insetting rubies into this thing. But the rubies actually have a total diameter of 0.8 of a millimeter. So it's very fine work. And that having that skin underneath, you often see it on Niels Vandenberg's workstation because he actually works at a jeweler's table. It's not something you see in knife making studios very often, but that skin underneath catches all of the stuff that inevitably drops. And I must have dropped that 100 different things 100 different times each, and that skin caught it every time, and I haven't dropped anything on the floor, which has been phenomenal. So I don't know how I lived without it. Even though it's just a miniature one, it's very handy. I highly recommend building one for yourself.
I have like seriously considered altering my desk here that I work at into a jeweler's desk purely because I drop stuff all the time.
Oh yeah, it's a pain. But I've also been making custom tooling for this folder because a lot of the clamps and things that I own, even the smallest ones that I had, were way too big for the types of clamping that I've been needing to do. And so I thought, I've got a mill, I've got a lathe, I'll make my own clamps. And once again, it's one of those things you don't think of doing and then you do it. And then you think, oh, why didn't I do this a long time ago? I need a whole set of these things. So, but this is why we do these projects, to challenge ourselves and reshape our paradigms. And it, you know, echoes of what I'm doing now will reflect in future work from here on in, and I'll have more projects like this, but this is why we do it. So it's been fun. It's just been headache after headache of straining through optimizers. But I think it'll be worth it in the end. It's starting to look very knife-like for the first time recently. And, I'm very happy with how it's coming out. So, but it's been my whole world, really. My song of the week has a funny story behind it. I was I'm currently teaching my wife how to play acoustic guitar. She's always wanted to learn her whole life, and nobody's ever taught her. So I've been teaching her with my limited knowledge, and one of her favorite songs in the world is very notoriously difficult to play, unfortunately. And I was trying to, because I'm not a great guitarist, but I was trying to explain to her how it's difficult to play. And she's been learning just open chords, basic open chords. And the song she wanted to learn was, I've forgotten the name of the song now. It's the song about Elvis.
Graceland?
No, it's Black Velvet by Alana Miles. She wanted to learn. And that is a very difficult song to play at the best of times if you want to do it proper justice. And I was trying to explain to her why it's difficult. And I'm like, let's just look up a video of somebody playing it, and you'll be able to see why it's difficult, because I certainly can't show you because it's too hard. And what we found on YouTube amongst videos of people playing it was the coolest grandma I've ever seen in my life. Just woman in her 60s, just in sort of granny clothes and everything, but she was in the most decked out music studio I think I've ever seen, and she did a live looped version. If you're familiar with live looping, it's this sort of thing that's happening lately, and she did the most incredible live looped version of Black Velvet, and her voice was incredible and everything. And I'm like, this is the coolest grandma I've ever seen. She's brilliant. But all along her studio were posters of Melissa Etheridge, you know, from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, geez, this woman's a real Melissa Etheridge fan. And I looked her up. It is Melissa Etheridge. she never gave it up. Now she has a YouTube channel where she does like live looping and stuff like this. Like, music has just become her life, and she's just turned into the coolest grandma that has ever lived.
That's awesome.
But I was, and when I found that out, it got me listening to her old stuff and everything. And I got back onto one of my favorite songs as a kid growing up was Bring Me Some Water, that Melissa Etheridge actually did. And so, yeah, I'd forgotten that song existed. It's been so long since I'd heard it. And hearing it again, it was my song of the week. But I definitely recommend looking up her YouTube channel, because she is just, she's a cool lady. Definitely worth looking up.
Absolutely. Awesome.
But with my spiel out of the way, what have you been up to, Sam?
Well, not as much as excitement as you've had. No, I mostly spent the week filing gravers and, you know, getting all of that stuff prepared for the Japanese style engraving class. I'm going to be doing an online class.
Cool.
And I'm going to be selling 4 sets of intro graver sets. So it'll be a 10 graver set with Kisage scraper as well and a hammer. But yeah, it's been something that's been in the works for a long time. It's just that because last week I was isolating because I had a close contact with COVID and had to make sure that I didn't infect my family, two of whom are immunocompromised, I basically was sat in my room all day doing nothing. So just filed up a whole bunch of gravers. I now have calluses on my calluses from all the filing I've done, but at least I have it done now. So yeah, no, that's basically taken up most of my time. I did get out to my friend Zach's Laughing Fish Forges Forge the other day, and we spent some time forging some blacksmith's knives, going over how to forge knives, because Zach's mostly a blacksmith who does like the most amazing decorative twists, but yeah, he hadn't done a lot of knife work, so we took some spring steel and made some blacksmith knives, and I was actually pretty happy with how they all came out. It was fun to get back on the hammer again and turn a 4.5-inch piece of steel into a 10-inch long knife. it just reminds you of how much blacksmithing is magic.
Yeah,
I just love it. But yeah, honestly, that has been everything. Just, you know, planning that kind of stuff. I have got a couple of guillotine tools that I recently just finished, and they've gone up on my Etsy page. And I've got to make another like 3 sets of dies because I think I have 3 frames left over. So yeah, just slowly chipping away at all the backlog of stuff. I've really got to work on the commissions that I've got laid back from like 1.5 years ago. And get started on my Journeyman Smith set. Yeah. If I'm ever going to get around to it. Oh, God.
Not going to make itself, Sam.
It's good.
No, I know.
Not even November yet, so you're in good shape time-wise.
Yeah,
Niels did his entire set, Master Smith set in 6 weeks.
Niels is crazy, yeah, and there was never any illusion about that.
No, nobody ever doubted.
Not even Niels denies that. Like, yeah. No, I don't think I'll be doing mine in 6 weeks. Let's be real.
Not with that attitude.
But I do have to start preparing stock for Perth Knife Show, which is in February, because I got to make stuff that sells now, and I've got to make stuff that I can sell later. If I'm only working on stuff that sells later, then I don't have anything now. And if I only work on stuff that I have now, I don't have any time to make the stuff that sells later. so you got to kind of mix it up. My song of the week this week is actually one that I actually haven't heard the full song. I will, like, straight up, I will be hearing it for the first time fully through on the Forgecast playlist. Because it only got released very, very recently. But I have been listening to the main hook of the song repeatedly because it's been coming up on my TikTok For You page, like, just repeatedly, and I love the hook so much. And it's called Everything's Fine by Roe Kapara. R-O-E Kapara.
Right.
K-A-P-A-R-A. And, yeah, it's got a very kind of late 90s kind of punk grunge feel. It's really fun, and I'm hoping the whole song is like that, but you know, we'll find out, I'm sure. But I've been like mad for wanting to hear this song, and it's only just got released like yesterday, I think. So yeah,
interesting. The video on YouTube is from 2 weeks ago.
I know, he's been like advertising it for ages.
Yeah, right.
It's been like slowly like eking it out, just kind of going, hey guys, it's coming. And it's like, God damn it, just released already. But yeah, anyway, with that being said, what have you been up to, Jordan?
This has been, I've been in India for 7 months now. I've been in India. So my weeks are typically all very different, but this week, at the beginning of the week, my mother was visiting from the U.S. So When she was visiting, we did a kind of blitz tour of a couple of tourist sites. Went from Delhi to Agra to see the Taj Mahal, and then down to Fatehpur Sikri, which is this abandoned fort, fort city that was built by Emperor Akbar. And then we came back to Udaipur and spent 5 days here and met all of my friends here, which was kind of a big job. And then had a birthday party for me, which was the biggest birthday party I've ever thrown, with 46 people there. all the while seeing some other tourist things in the old city here, the City Palace Museum, where I've been working, and going for boat rides on Lake Bichola. It's been a heck of a week. Lots of fun.
I have been loving following your journey in India. It's been absolutely amazing.
Thank you.
We were talking about you and your journey a while back, because we did an episode where, because we keep getting asked by our listeners who are often just starting out, how can we start out with as little as possible? And in that episode where we were talking about how there's so many places around the world where the concept of a shop in like America or something is foreign to them, and they do masterful work with very, very little. And the journey that you're on came up in that because you've been learning of these techniques that have been around for a very, very long time, done with very, very little, that rival things that are done today with modern machining.
Yeah.
And watching that journey play out is incredible.
It's been amazing for me. And in some ways, it's been a back to basics of sorts for me, because when I started out blacksmithing, I was just working with a hammer and an anvil and a forge, and then making my tools from there. And I think in India, there are some similarities. I mean, the forge that I've been working with, because it's a small shop, has been really small. The anvil's literally just like a 20-pound block of steel that is set onto a stump. It's very rudimentary what I've been working with. The blacksmiths who are professional blacksmiths from generations here have slightly better setups than I've been working with personally, but it's still often very, very far cry from what we see in the US. Power hammers are few and far between. They do exist here for sure.
Of course.
But most blacksmiths don't have power hammers. And the techniques of working are very different. People usually work on the floor. That people are kneeling or crouching for most of the day, or sitting actually for most of their forge work. And
as a Western person who spends very little time doing that kind of thing, my knees cry every time I see it.
Yeah, it'd be a good exercise. No.
Yeah,
it would be. Yeah. Well, before we get to, I want to explore this journey that you're on while we've got you. But for the listeners of ours who are not familiar with your work, do you want to talk about how you got your start? Where the Jordan journey began?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends on when you want to start. I mean, I've been interested in knives and swords for a very long time. But I think, you know, even as a kid, I always loved to make things. I was, you know, of course, making my own little wooden swords and stuff at age 4 and 5. But my journey into blacksmithing and knife making really started in when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And my family had moved to a retired dairy farm in upstate New York. And I became really interested in traditional, 19th century American farming practices. And I was also really interested in timber framing and woodworking with hand tools. And I wanted to be able to make all of my own tools and equipment for the farm and hardware and all that sort of thing. So everything seemed to bring me back to blacksmithing. Like, this is where it all starts. So I took a workshop, 3-day workshop at Salem Art Works in Salem, New York. And I absolutely loved blacksmithing. And so from there, I just started, as I mentioned, I got a forge and an anvil kind of by talking to local blacksmiths and figuring out, all right, who has these things that I can buy. I actually made the forge with the help of a machinist friend. Mm-hmm. And then I spent 2, 3, 4 years just working in my shop, you know, after school, and on my summer breaks and whatnot, equipping my blacksmith shop with tools and doing mostly blacksmithing things. I made my first knife at age 16, and then once I graduated high school and went to college, then I was looking at ways to maybe make my blacksmithing into a full-time career after college. And so I kind of gravitated toward knife making because it seemed accessible to me for some reason, I guess maybe just because of the scale. And I fell in love with knife making because it allows me to work in so many different media. You know, I can be a blacksmith and a machinist, and I can do polished finish jewelry type work, and I can work with non-ferrous metals and do leather work and woodwork and put it all into one product that is not only a work of art, but it's also useful. And so that combination of all of those things really meant that knives were a perfect medium of expression for me. So that's kind of how I got into knives. And I got, let's see, when around the beginning of college, you know, 18, 19 years old, I joined the American Bladesmith Society, and that was really instrumental in my development as a bladesmith because it gave me benchmarks to work to. You know, it gave me goals of the journeyman smith and the master smith, the stamps and the very high precision fit and finish requirements that those tests require. It really drove me to improve my craft, and so I feel like I improved more as a bladesmith making those two sets, the journeyman and the mastersmith set, than at any other points in my knife making career.
No pressure, Sam.
Well, see, the beautiful thing about that test is whether you pass or fail, you're still going to be a better knife maker after you make that set.
Mm. Oh, yeah, 100%.
And that's the reason to make the set.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what I always tell people when they ask me whether they should join the ABS, is, well, why would you join the ABS? It just pushes you.
Yeah, exactly. When you have to work to a standard, then you raise your own standards. And so that will make you a better knife maker. It'll make you look at your process, make you look really critically at your work and see what can I do better?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, like, moving in on from that, actually, funnily enough, you were my inspiration of the week all those many months ago. I can't even remember. It's like 2 years now, I think.
Yeah, it was a while, yeah.
We've
been doing the show a long time.
Because of your Tolwar build. And I remember that episode specifically because I was an idiot and I was like, oh, you know, like, he made a Tolwar, and there was someone on Forged in Fire that made a Tolwar recently, and then we realized
it was the same guy.
we're on the episode, and he's like, Sam, yeah, no, that was him. I was like, oh, but like, yeah, for me, because like I love Tolwar, Pulwar, you know, like a lot of those, you know, Eastern style blades, especially. The construction that goes around Tolwar hilts. And so like that was when I started following you and watching your work. And then so to see you in India, like learning from some of the masters in India, it was just felt like it went full circle. And I was like, perfect.
You know, that's really, I mean, I'm glad to hear that. I'm honored, but yeah, in some ways it did start my journey to India in some ways did start with Forged in Fire. When I went on Forged in Fire, I had never heard of a Tolwar before. I had almost no experience with Indian weapons whatsoever. You know, I guess like had seen kind of Indian inspired daggers and that sort of thing, but I wasn't well versed in the historical weapons at that point. And so when I made the Tolwar on Forged in Fire, I had to do a lot of really quick research in the day they give you to travel between New York and your home forge. And so, yeah, I was doing this research, trying to figure out how they were made. And then I eventually won the episode. Spoilers. If you haven't watched it, it's been 5 years. Yeah. So you probably didn't care so much. So I won the episode, and then after that, I was getting these orders for people wanting me to make Tolwars, and I felt just grossly unqualified to do this because what do I know about a Tolwar? I made one in 5 days on a reality TV show. And so for the subsequent Tolwars, then I was doing more research and I was looking at, okay, how were they actually constructed? What are the ways that they were decorated? And looking at Kofgari in particular as one kind of method of decoration that was, we don't really see in most American work. I mean, like, or most modern bladesmithing, Kofgari is not commonly used. So for those who don't know, Kofgari is a technique of applying gold or silver decorations to an iron surface. And it's done with putting very fine wire onto a prepared ground that you've kind of roughened with a series of very tightly spaced scratches. And so you apply
the Japanese,
you burnish it down.
In the Japanese tradition, it's Nunome Zogan, and in like the European, it's Damascening. But yeah,
exactly, and it's most similar to Damascening. Actually, there was a lot of Nunome Zogan is, I think, a slightly different technique from Kofgari in terms of the tools and materials that are used.
Well, yeah,
but it's a similar principle. It's a metal overlay. Yeah. Damascene is actually very similar, and there was some overlap in the craftsmen who were doing this sort of work because Europe and India were so very tightly connected for hundreds of years, from the Silk Route initially, through, of course, British colonization in the 18th and 19th centuries. So there was a huge amount of trade, and then obviously the in colonization, and there was a lot of back and forth of craftsmen from Europe to India. And so Damascene is found in both places. Yeah.
But like the thing for me was actually recently I was commenting on one of your videos of Master doing some work in Kofgari, because you almost never see it. You know, like there is very little reference material out there for Kofgari. There's a lot for like Damascening, and there's a lot for like the Western tradition, and there's obviously a lot for the Japanese Nunome Zogan, which is, as you say, a little bit different. And so just to see someone actually filming, recording some Kofgari was just like amazing. Yes.
Yeah,
excellent.
That was what I found as well. And part of the reason I came to India is like, I felt like I couldn't adequately learn about these cultures of blade making without actually going and visiting and seeing, you know, what are the craftsmen doing today. And the way I've structured my Indian research project is, part of it is working with the local craftsmen here and learning from them. And the other part is working in the City Palace Museum, which has an extensive arms collection, antique arms collection. It was an armory. So I get to go in and look at these historical pieces and really get a sense for how they used to be made in addition to how they're being made today.
Yeah,
it'd be absolutely fascinating, mind-bending stuff. I mean, every day you'd learn something new, a little extra tidbit.
Oh, no doubt. And there's so many different ways that any particular shape were constructed. And they think about metal in different ways. I mean, which makes complete sense. But when you or I design a knife, there is almost always in the back of our heads, how am I going to construct this shape? What tools do I have that are going to make this shape? And so it makes complete sense that if you have a different set of tools, you have access to a different set of tools, then you're going to gravitate toward different kinds of shapes. And so it's been really interesting to look at, say, the way that the Indian smiths have used sheet metal in their work. You know, as most people, you look at a tulwar grip, and it's sheet metal, basically, that's been hollow-formed to the right size. And then it's been, either brazed or forge-welded or a combination thereof into the shape, and then kind of burnished all over.
I actually purchased an 18th century tulwar hilt from India. It was rusted to hell, and I didn't really care about the overall finish. But what I wanted to do was find out how it was constructed. So I did a pretty aggressive acid soak to get the details, because I never knew how they were constructed. Right. And so when I finally pulled it out of the acid and got to see the copper lines of the brazing and like the construction, it still blew my mind that they were able to do that. You know, considering like in the 18th century, they weren't, you know, like walking around with blowtorches.
Sure they just wired it all together and fluxed it and stuck it in the forge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's absolutely insane.
It's, I imagine you've been learning quite a few new techniques. Do you have one that's stood out that sort of completely changed your trajectory moving forward for future projects, when you just had the sort of, oh my God, I must use this for the rest of my life now? Any of those pop out?
You know, yes and no, because in some ways, metalwork is metalwork. We all do kind of the same stuff. So looking at the old pieces and seeing, that the brazing techniques or the ways that sheet metal is used, those are definitely going to have some impact in my work moving forward. I think I'm a little bit less scared of, say, raising and hollow forming parts for knives and swords and that sort of thing. Kofgari obviously is a technique that I didn't know much about going into this, and so that's, I would expect to, I'm expecting to practice and use that on some of my work going forward as well. In terms of other bladesmithing construction techniques, I don't know that I've really noticed anything completely groundbreaking. It's actually been interesting to note all of the similarities. And I should also say that, India is, it's a global country. Like they have access to many of the tools and equipment than we have today. I mean, if you go into most blacksmith shops now, they're making all this stuff with angle grinders and oxyacetylene torches. They're not doing it the quote unquote traditional way that they would have 200 years ago.
The way you were just before, like being afraid of sort of raising sheet metal and things, sometimes the revelations that you can have when you're learning from somebody else is literally overcoming that. Because a lot of the times in your work, you will know that you are capable of doing a thing, but you'll shy away from doing it because it's not what you normally do. And it's a bit like what you were saying before, you'll settle into a pattern of using the tools that you have in a certain workflow because of that. But having those awakenings of, oh, I could do this, and having it be an accessible tool in your mind instead of something you would have to force yourself to do, it can often change your workflow and open up new avenues for you. You'll start tackling those problems, those design problems, in a different way because something has now become normalized for you.
Yes. Oh, that's absolutely right. I think one really good example of that, and this is in part because it's so easy to manufacture, but the square ricasso is, something that we all design into knives all the time. Ricasso with two parallel sides. And you don't see this on historical pieces because it wasn't easy to do historically. But if you have a surface grinder, it's really, really easy. These sorts of things, like, I it definitely gets my brain jogging, like, okay, maybe I don't have to make everything I make, with a square ricasso and a milled guard. Maybe there's a way to add some more.
Well, that's what leads to people like David Lish coming up with really new takes on old things. And I mean, it takes people doing things that are now considered radical that may not have been one time. I mean, it's just like fashion. It's got to happen in cycles, because what we're doing now, we're kind of doing as an art form, whereas for the vast majority of history, it was more than just an art form. It was a practical part of daily life.
Right. And it was always an art form as well. I think weapon making has always been, a weapon is an object of power, both literally and symbolically, and it always has been. And so weapons have been decorated for as long as they've been weapons.
Yeah.
And I suppose there's also a really big cultural kind of side to that, because, you know, in the Western world, we see two very separate kinds of knife making. We either see people who are taking, like, the more Japanese tradition, or they're taking the Western tradition. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you very rarely see people moving outside of that culturally. And so I think, like, what I'm really interested in is to see how, like, the cultural perspective of the Indian smiths changes, you know, like, your approach to certain things as well. Because, like, as you said, your tools define how you work your material. But at the same time, I think culturally, we all tend to align ourselves with a certain style and with a certain tool set. Like, ABS smiths always tend to end up making similar looking knives for a while before they find their own kind of voice. And I haven't seen too many smiths taking inspiration from that kind of either Middle Eastern or, you know, Indian, Pakistani, that kind of area. I can't a lot of inspiration from those areas. And I'm really keen to see that kind of maybe take on a little bit more prevalence in our community for a while.
Especially since it has such a rich culture with ironwork going back so long.
People throw around the word Persian a lot in design, in Western design right now. And I do see a fair bit of I do see, like, certain smiths are using kind of Indian and Persian and Middle Eastern influences in their work right now. I mean, you see Niels Vandenberg, for instance, just made a conjure in his workshop, in his style. And I think you see Andrew Mears, for instance, was working on a Bichwa-styled dagger. It's just like a South Indian-type dagger. And so there are certain, like, styles that you'll see. I know Tom Ward has done some Indo-Persian inspired things. But I think in terms of the construction techniques, people are often still very much rooted in their kind of Western square ricasso style, manufacturing. And so what I'm interested in some ways is trying to bring more of the historical techniques and seeing where that takes the art and the craft.
Yeah, no, like that, and that's what I mean is, like, you know, you do, as you say, you do see those blade designs and, like, the overall aesthetic being, you know, kind of Ottoman, Persian, whatever you want to call it. But, the construction techniques aren't the same. And so there is this very obvious disconnect from the culture that the knife is from. Whereas, like, in people in the West who make a lot of, like, Japanese style stuff, for instance, they tend to use a lot of more Japanese style construction methods. So in order to feel, you know, quote unquote, more authentic. And so I'd like to see that move happen in, like, the Indo-Persian stuff as well. Because you kind of lose part of, like, I hate to say it, but the soul of the piece. If the, you know, like, it's great to have a mingling of cultures, but if you're trying to recreate something from a culture, it's nice to be able to use those techniques to kind of partake of that culture a bit.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree. I also didn't mean at all to disparage the work of Niels or Andrew Mears in any way with saying that they use the kind of Western style construction, because I really appreciate the way that they blend these cultures. I should just qualify by saying that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you also, you work in the medium that you used
to. So.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, as being a master smith yourself, with a lot of knife makers looking up to you, it might help inspire some more smiths to take on, change these paradigms that they're locked into and start expanding their construction view, because it's all just additional tools in the belt, whether you use them all the time or not. It expands the capabilities that you have, and thus, like we were talking about before, the way you approach the challenge of construction.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And the big thing it comes back to, and one of the reasons that I've been so happy seeing, like, you posting on Instagram about your journey and what you're learning, is because the way we, like, implement that is by learning this stuff. And unfortunately, as we've noted earlier, you can't get easy access to a lot of these old techniques from that region, because it just isn't online. Like, it's just nowhere.
It was on the episode that we brought your journey up, actually, we were bemoaning the fact, my favorite type of knife of all, as a knife enthusiast, a person who makes their living making knives, the one that if I could only pick one would be a kukri. I love kukris, and I was bemoaning the fact that realistically I will probably never be able to achieve this, although maybe in my future. I would love to go to Nepal and just hand myself over to apprentice under somebody that's still doing it. One of the old families is still doing it, just to see how they do it and absorb as much of it as possible, because the little glimpses that you get of it through YouTube and online, and they're doing such amazing work with so little compared to what I have the privilege of having in my workshop. And I want that purity. I want to chase that and add it to the work that I do, and see that you can do more with less, because it comes down to a deep understanding of the technique itself, and not the way that technique is necessarily executed. It's the knowing the why. We talk about that a lot on this show. A lot of people will learn the what and the how, but they'll forget the why of a technique.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. I strongly encourage you to do that, to go and see if you can meet some of these guys. I think it would be very possible.
Maybe. So. If I keep getting flooded, I might just be able to build a boat and just drift over there. So, Jordan, we have listeners sending questions via email to us that we answer on the show, and you're welcome to help pitch in on some answers if you'd like. And they can. Sure. But before we do, I just realized we forgot to get your song of the week.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I've been, I guess... Let's see, I could go a couple of different ways with this. I've been playing a lot of guitar lately, and I find myself, when I'm pressed for time, mostly just gravitating back toward bluegrass fiddle tunes and playing those on guitar. So one song that I particularly like, but I haven't listened to in a while, is Bela Fleck, Wheels Up. Bela Fleck is a terrific banjo player, for those of you don't know, and his song Wheels Up is just terrific, like high energy bluegrass.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So I think your listeners may enjoy that one.
How do you spell the band?
Bela Fleck is the artist, B-E-L-A-F-L-E-C-K. B-E-L-A.
Oh, yep, I gotcha. I've not heard of them before. I'll definitely have to add that. I don't think, have we got bluegrass on the playlist yet?
I actually don't think we do, which is crazy, because like
we have the most eclectic mix of music on that playlist you will ever see. It's crazy.
Yeah, I could drop in some Hindi pop too if you want.
next go around.
Yeah. Next time you're on the show. Well, we'll dive into these emails. We've got three today, and our first one is from Leaf. And he says, "Hi, gents. Love the show. Haven't been listening or beating metal for long, but glad my little sister, Kat Van Forge, introduced me to blacksmithing and your show. I'm looking for advice for a gas forge to buy. Financially, I like the kits you can get from Gamerco here in Australia. Unfortunately, I'm not great at welding. In fact, I'd say I'm pretty shithouse. I just don't trust myself risking the combination of dodgy welds and fire. I've looked at a couple of secondhand kit forges, but it's hard to tell if they're worth the risk, if its builder is even half as bad as I am. What I want is something I would be able to take and use to forge weld, probably a largish single burner. I've sourced one for about $1,000 Australian, brand new, including freight. Is that a reasonable price, or can you recommend where to get a pre-built forge? Thanks, boys. Leaf."
Thanks, so, Leaf.
Yeah. I mean, the little devil forges are pretty good. I'm not sure what their capabilities for forge welding are like, but they're already pre-done. I'd probably want to seal the isowall refractory that they come with.
I had the opportunity to work with the Moosehead Forge, which is an actually really, really reasonably priced forge made here in Australia.
Is it a kit or is it a pre-built?
I think it's pre-built. It came pre-built for the friend of mine that bought it, so already done. And then there's also Alpha Wolf Forge.
Yes.
Makes the 9-kilo bottle forges. So,
yep.
All of those are pretty usable. About $1,000 is about what you'd be expecting to pay for a decent forge with
here
burner.
In Australia, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I understand not wanting to trust your welds, but the best way to get better at welding is to weld.
And as a metal worker, the ability to weld is invaluable. Even welding badly, you know, take the attitude of I welded, it helded. I've been teaching my wife to weld since she started knife making. I'm like, I'm not doing your welds for you. You got to learn to weld. I taught her the old concrete drop test. You know, once you've welded something, peg it at the concrete floor. If it holds, it's good.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, the other thing about welding in a forge construction is that it's actually very low stakes because you don't.
There's
it's not
no
pressurized.
Stress on it.
It's not under any sort of stress except for heat expansion, and so yeah.
So the only thing that might pop is tack welds. Everything else is probably going to hold, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you should see the welds on some of my early forges.
Yeah. See, watch Sam's video of him welding up his, what was it, the swage block stand. Oh, man.
Hey, you know, funnily enough, those welds are probably some of the worst welds I've ever done. And that swage block is still standing. And I've hit that thing with 10-pound sledgehammers and, like, I've wailed on it.
And that's not a small swage block either.
No. It's a 50-kilo swage block. I'm just wailing on it.
So hopefully that helps, Leaf. Our next email comes from Jacob, and he says, "Hi, guys. Not a question, but a general recommendation that I think people might find useful. I've found the most consistent way to temper knives is in a propane grill. You can dial in the temperature very precisely. I use an inexpensive thermocouple to monitor temperature, but you could also use a couple of oven thermometers, and I do as an extra precaution. I find that once it warms up, it will stay within a few degrees either side of the temperature you are looking for. I typically wait for my steady state temperature, then put my knives in it. I will take it will take a lot of playing around with to figure out how many burners need to be on and how much they need to be on, but it's well worth it for the consistency. Take care, Jacob."
Thanks, Jacob.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend that, but I mean, if it's working for you, how are you judging its consistency? Is it just the colors that you're getting? Because that could be the amount of oxidization that can happen might change inside a gas environment.
Well, he's talking about putting thermometers in there. I mean, I think thermometers are the important thing.
Yeah.
If you're doing it in your kitchen oven, put two kitchen thermometers in there. That'd be good.
Also, burying it in a bed of sand as well while it's in there will help make it a bit more of an even spread of the temperature.
Yeah.
That's true.
I mean, like I temper my swords in my Don Fogg kiln, which is gas powered. The problem with gas-powered anything, like kilns and stuff like that, is that you have to monitor them.
Yeah.
Because gas pressure fluctuation, you know, like the increase in airflow because of, you know, cross breezes and stuff like that can affect the temperature over time. Whereas with electric kilns and electric ovens, it's literally set it and forget it. You know, I advise using oven thermometers in your electric oven to find out where your hotspots are and stuff like that as well. But electric is going to be a little bit more repeatable because normally they have a solenoid that kicks them on and off when they reach temperature.
One other thing that it might be worth considering, it might not, but your average grill or barbecue doesn't have any sort of insulation around the outside. And all of the heat will be coming from one direction, which for a small basic knife project with a simple steel like 1084, 1095 or something, you'd probably be able to get a perfectly fine heat treat on. But some of the more complex things, once again, burying it in sand will mitigate that quite a bit. But I don't know. I mean, if it works for you, then that's handy. That's a handy tip. So, yeah. Thanks for sharing, Jacob. Our final email comes from Corey. And he says, "Hey guys, had a quick question for you. I'm in the process of making a hammer from 1045 and was curious about the heat treat temper regimen you guys would use for it. I don't have a kiln or anything, just a forge and a home oven. I appreciate any advice you can give. Love the Forgecast, and I appreciate the knowledge you guys are sharing with us all. Thanks. Well, thank you, Corey.
Forge and home oven's all I use.
Yeah, well.
1045 is a relatively forgiving steel, fortunately.
And most people, when they make hammers, they don't even temper in an oven. They will actually heat up a drift and sit the hammer eye, the drift, and heat it from the middle of the eye, completely detempering the cheeks of the hammer, and just waiting for the brownish hue that you want to reach the polished faces.
Yep. Yeah. The other thing to think about with hammer temper is how hard you actually want that hammer. If it's a forging hammer, you probably want it softer than your anvil. You might not even need to heat treat it, you know, completely, or at least drive that temper back pretty far, because if that hammer misses and takes a chip out of your anvil, it's way easier to replace the hammer than it is the anvil.
And those chips can fly off like bullets sometimes.
Yeah. You don't want to mess with that.
Yeah, no. So for the hammers that I sell, they're all 1045 and they're hardened in water, like 1045 is supposed to be, from critical temperature, which is just above non-magnetic, around 1550 Fahrenheit-ish. And then they're tempered at about 220 to 250 degrees Celsius for 2 hours. So they're probably coming out at about like 50 Rockwell, maybe. I haven't actually Rockwell tested them because I'm looking for softer than my anvil face, just like Jordan has said.
Yeah. So hopefully that gives you some direction there, Corey. Good luck with it. He did send a photo of the hammer. It looks good. It's a dog's head style, which, you know, nice. Sam and I are big fans of.
Yeah.
That's all the emails. And I wanted to actually ask you, obviously, with the amazing work that you do, Jordan, and now that you're a mastersmith as well, we've mentioned before, you'll be an inspiration to a lot of other knife makers. But who is an inspirer of you and your work?
There are so many. I guess, you know.
Feel free to shout out a few people if you need. Don't necessarily need to limit yourself.
One person who actually really inspires me is Jeffrey Funk at the New Agrarian School. He's a blacksmith and not a bladesmith, but he makes a lot of tools, a lot of both agricultural tools and blacksmithing tools. And, the main reason he inspires me is that I feel like his workshop is the most well-designed workshop I've ever been in. It's just one of the best spaces to work, just beautifully designed, and the way he thinks about projects is inspiring to me. I'll also throw out one knife maker who's inspiring to me, who is Lynn Ray, and maybe he's been an inspiration to people in the past, but we were talking earlier about people who are using older techniques of working metal and integrating them into modern designs, and I think Lynn Ray is very innovative in that way, really taking things that have been around for centuries and reinventing them in very creative ways.
Absolutely. Also, his superhuman ability to get amazing forged finishes.
Yes, yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah, Lynn is a machine.
I don't know what a deal he did with whom to get that amazing level of skill, but goddamn, he's good. He's very good.
He met someone at the crossroads and down in the bayou somewhere.
Had a guitar battle with him.
Yeah,
that's it. So what's the next big project, Jordan? What's the next masterwork?
Well, you know, it's hard to say exactly. I mean, I'm going to be in India for another 2 months, basically. And my access, you know, my time here is very divided. I'm not spending a lot of time in the shop per se. So I'm currently working on two chef knives that I'm doing kind of in collaboration with Rahul and Sandeep, who are the Koftgari artists that I'm studying with. And so hopefully in the next few weeks, we'll be able to start the Koftgari work on these chef knives. And so,
awesome.
Those are the next projects. And the hope is that they'll be finished up by the time I leave India. And then
now you'll know that every post you do, you'll have Sam glued to his phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Scouring every second of the videos.
I've been quiet on Instagram for the past couple of weeks, so we'll have to revive the page.
Yeah. I haven't noticed at all. I haven't been like waiting for a post.
He hasn't been checking your page and hitting refresh at all.
There you go. Well, we'll do what we can. Also, I should say Will Stelter is actually going to come out and visit for a little bit of time. So if we have some
kids
some
getting around,
there, he really is.
Yeah, that guy he's got wheels. He goes all over the place.
Good on him.
So he's coming to visit for 10 days or so. So we'll have a little bit of time in the shop, probably, hopefully, and a little bit of time seeing.
I have no doubt hijinks will be had.
Oh, yeah. Shenanigans. Yes.
No doubt. No doubt. So.
So one question I like to ask people. Do you have a dream project, sort of something, some big project on the horizon that you know you're not ready for yet, but it's something that one day you hope to be?
You know, I think, I mean, the idea of like being ready for a project is, I guess, maybe not exactly the way I think about things when I approach projects. I've gotten a lot of orders in the past for things that I didn't really feel ready for, and I took them anyway and just went with them. And I don't regret that. I think there's a real value in pushing yourself to improve in the ways that you need to improve. I mean, part of the readiness is just having the time to do it. So
yeah,
I think there's going to be a bigger Indian sword project in my future using some pretty traditional techniques. That's something that I would very much like to take on, but not something that I've very thoroughly planned at present.
You're right.
I will be following that with bated breath.
I think we all will.
I mean, like the big thing for me, like the exciting thing for me is that not only is it like that you have this information now and are making it accessible, but you're making it accessible in a way that like people like me who don't speak Hindi can take in. Because, you know, like you can find reference sources for stuff like Koftgari and stuff like that, but it's very rare. And when you do find it, it's normally in Hindi.
I've actually found some other books that have good information on it since I've been in India. And actually a lot of the research that has been done on arms and armor in this world have been done by British people. So there are quite a few books and I can maybe see if I can curate a small list of pieces that might be, you know, just reference material that might be advantageous to people who are interested in arms from this region.
That would be very helpful. Yeah, absolutely.
Because I know this. I know the research was done. It's just finding the stuff.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. It's a kind of small area of research in some ways. You know, there aren't that many scholars who study weapons from this part of the world.
Which is a shame because of its rich history.
Right. Right.
And I mean, like something I wanted to touch on before we headed off was the fact that there is this kind of stigma surrounding Indian Pakistani craftsmanship in the modern world because of, you know, like the advent of, you know,
the fake Damascus and
all that sort mass of distributors thing. Of, you know, lower quality work for, you know, that for cheap. And so that always kind of irked me because, you know, I was very well aware of the historical nature of like Indian, Pakistani, you know, Syrian, that kind of work being absolutely fantastic, you know, like even to people of the time, you know, there was a great appreciation for craftsmanship in that area. And so like, I feel like that stigma has in some ways, like
detracted.
Yeah, been the reason that there is less access to information surrounding that form of craftsmanship because people are like, oh no, Indian bad.
Certainly, certainly. I'm really glad you brought this up, because it is something that I wrestle with and that I've had to reckon with in certain ways. There is absolutely a stigma against, well, in the West, there's a stigma against Indian and Pakistan, and their production. If you come to India, there's a stigma against Pakistani production. You know, so the Indians say, oh, well, we're a step above Pakistan. I think there are a couple of things, you know, that kind of play into how this has all evolved. And I think, you know, one of them is that the way the economy is structured here, and the way that the industrialization has happened, is that India is further behind the curve of industrialization than, say, the U.S. or U.K. or Australia or most of Europe. And so they're very much in a production mindset. And the way that production economics work is it's a haggle economy. It's, you know, who can make the cheapest thing
a numbers game
in the least amount of time. And so there isn't a market for high dollar value pieces coming out of India. The other problem is, especially with regard to weapons, and swords and daggers and knives and you know, edged weapons. India has kind of hamstrung itself with regulations in some ways, for the handicraftsmen. So, like, you can't. There's a real stigma against knives in India, which is kind of interesting,
right,
given this long history. And so many people own historical swords, but there's not a market among Indians for new swords or new knives, except for the kind of throwaway ones that they use in the kitchen. And so so the craftsmen are struggling to find markets for their work. And the market that's been most accessible to them has been the ones that are ridiculously cheap going to US. There are some exceptions to that. And I have seen some factories in India that are actually producing really high quality work. High quality, like work that would rival, what we'd see in most manufacturing in the US. And that does exist, but it is maybe the exception.
The exception, not the rule
at the moment.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll see like an increase in that kind of thing as the market opens up to them more, in the future.
Exactly.
It's a historical thing. Like, you know, historically there's always been a certain country that has like been synonymous with shoddy craftsmanship. Like for a very long period after World War II, Japan was seen as like, you know, anything made in Japan was crap.
Right.
And then, you know, nowadays anything made in Japan is amazing. You know, like, so,
exactly.
You know, I think we're just in that cycle right now where, you know, like things that are like India and Pakistan and that area of the world are all synonymous with like, you know, that cheap mass production, that kind of thing. Exactly. But I'm hoping to see like, as the economy improves, as the global market,
wheels turn.
As the global market turns over, we'll see that craftsmanship come back start to appreciate it again.
And I think India is very much on that track. I think Pakistan will take a little bit longer in that, but it is the trajectory, right? It is the trajectory that we see of going from cheap labor, cheap everything, cheap quality to, you know, growing the manufacturing capabilities and the body of knowledge in the craftspeople in a country, and to the point where people are producing high quality stuff again.
And hopefully there's those pockets of craftsmen that will keep the cultural like heritage alive long enough for it to be passed on to those that community. And that's, you know, that's the really important thing.
And people such as yourself who will actually take it and bring it out to other countries to show people, you know, that may otherwise not see.
Yes, I agree. I think that's very valuable and something that I think Japan has, well, I don't know if Japan specifically has benefited from it, but I think that Japanese knives in particular, but also woodworking tools and woodworking techniques have been really romanticized in US because of the story that's been told about them. And the same story has not been told about Indian craftsmen and Indian knives and Indian swords. And so, you know, insofar as the story that you tell has a power to affect the way that people perceive an entire culture and craft. And so being able to be a messenger of that story could be of help to that country and that craft culture as well.
Glorious Utapa steel slicing through gun barrels.
Yeah, that's it. But I mean, I feel like as blacksmiths, you know, practicing an art that is considered, you know, dead, quote unquote, coming back to life, thankfully, I feel like it's almost an obligation of ours to, like, keep counsel or keep the, you know, like, keep writing down the history of our art in, like, any corner of the world and, like, keeping that flowing on and not fucking dying out.
Well, it's that philosophical concept of the second death, isn't it? You die first when your body dies, but you die your true death when people stop saying your name. And it's kind of the same with crafts. As long as people keep talking about it, even if people aren't necessarily doing it, if they keep those traditions talked about, if they keep the materials and the techniques talked about and discussed and written down and documented, it never goes away, and it can always, that brief spark can always reignite the flame.
Exactly.
We've gotten deep. We've gotten all philosophical
here.
It's the signal the episode's gone too long. We'll wrap it up. Massive thanks for taking the time to come on the show, Jordan. I know that it's not always easy with the time differences and things, but we're really grateful that you're able to make the time to actually talk to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been fun talking with you guys.
If our listeners wanted to track you down, where do you want to shout out all the places they can find you?
Udaipur? The best place really is Instagram, Jordan Lamote Blades on Instagram. You can also look at my website, jordanlamote.com. And I'm also on Facebook, Jordan Lamote Blades. And between those three, you should be covered. I've got a couple of YouTube videos that people have found helpful in the past, a little tutorial videos if people are curious, but it's not a very active platform for me personally.
Not working on any gold overlay YouTube videos.
Not at the moment. I got my hands
Sam
full.
Sam can watch 100 times. I can imagine. Well, if any listeners have any questions that they want to send to the show, blacksmithing or bladesmithing, we're here for you. Just either slide into our DMs or on Facebook and Instagram under the Forgecast, or you can email them to ask.forgecast@gmail.com and they might get answered on the show. If people are looking for you, Sam, where can they find you?
You can find me at Sam Towns Bladesmith on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Etsy, Patreon, Redbubble, the kitchen sink on TikTok. Where can they find you, Alex?
I go by Valhalla Ironworks, and you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Redbubble, Patreon, and check out my online courses, which you can find the links to those on my Instagram bio.
Hopefully this won't be the last time we see you on the show, but thank you so much for hanging out with us today, Jordan. It was
great. My pleasure. Anytime.
I hope everyone stays safe, keeps the fires lit, and we'll see you all next week.
Bye-bye.
is yours.